Hello, and welcome to the LA Venture Podcast. This is Minnie Ingersoll, host of the podcast and partner at 10110. 10110 is a seed stage fund here in LA. All opinions expressed on this show by me and my guests are solely our own. If you are interested in LA Venture, go to 10110.net/podcast, where I've made a sortable list of all of the great LA VCs who've been on this show. I am excited to have Marlon Nichols with me today. Marlon is a founding managing partner at Mac Venture Capital, a seed stage fund that fairly recently announced a $110 million fund one. Prior to Mac, Marlon was a founder of Cross Culture Ventures and investment director at Intel Capital. Marlon has an eye for consumer behavior shifts and cultural trends that I'm excited to talk about today. Hi, Marlon.
Hey, Minnie.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Great. Well, I gave a little introduction, but actually I was just thinking, I didn't really mention who's who at Mac. I've had Mike Palenk on the show and he was fantastic, but maybe we could start there and tell me about the partnership.
Yeah. Palenk is amazing. So hard, going to be a hard act to follow. But yeah, the general partnership is four of us. So there's Adrian Fenty, who was the fifth mayor of Washington, D.C., and spent close to 5 years at Andreessen Horowitz, helping to build out their post-investment regulatory practice. And then Mike Palenk, who you've had on the show. You know, Mike started his career at WME. He was an agent there, then led business development for Will Smith's family office, had interim CEO and CFO roles at a number of startups before becoming employee number one at Macro. And then Charles King, who was the founder and CEO at Macro. And then myself.
I mean, it's an amazing lineup. What are the personalities? I'm super curious, like who's the optimistic one? Who's the, you know, pessimistic one?
Oh, I mean, I think to work in venture, everyone has to be optimistic.
No, there are a lot of pessimistic people too.
Not on our team, then. We're all glass half full, and it's one of the things that we screen for, actually. Hmm. But doesn't mean we're pie in the sky either, right? We're definitely realistic. In terms of personality types, I'd say Adrian is more of a kind of a decision maker. Mike is deep in the data. And I think Charles and I are somewhere in between those two.
And so when you as a team are looking at these companies, you know, I said that you have a good sense of consumer behavior shifts. Are there any particular behavior shifts you're focused on, or do you have any insights on where things are going?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, so we've written about a few of them. Some of the latest ones were the conscious consumer and how consumers are showing that they're more and more interested and involved in political topics and matters that affect the planet and things like that. And, you know, how they're basically leveraging their wallets to, you know, force enterprises to, you know, to also pay attention.
And for those consumer behaviors, are you mining data sources when you look at this? Do you have good data on either where they're spending or their time or their money?
Yeah. The way that we do this process, I kind of went into kind of the team's background, and because of those backgrounds and networks that we've built, you know, it's an interesting mix of people throughout the world. And we tap into those folks, call them influencers or tastemakers, and we try to find common links, throughout, you know, these people and throughout the world. And once we see something that's popping up over and over again, that tells us that there's something interesting happening here that we should pay attention to.
Do you have an example of like one of those, like a tastemaker conversation where that stands out in your mind that's influenced your thinking?
There's a lot. Let me see. One of the topics that we went into was around, we call it the unperfect parent.
I like it already.
Right. Just basically saying that there is no such thing as a perfect parent. We talked to a number of parents, and some of those parents were entertainers, right? What we came to was that every parent seemingly felt like they didn't have enough time with their kids, right? So you talk about infants, for instance. A lot of folks are spending an inordinate amount of time researching like nutrition. what should I be feeding my baby, right? So that's one thing. Another thing was around meal preparation. And so that led to an investment in a company called Yumi, baby food company. You know, baby food is not an amazing investment thesis, but the unperfect parent is the fact that households have changed significantly over the last, you know, from the 60s to now, right? Where you started out with like patriarch going off to work, matriarch staying at home with the children and baking pies. But what is most true, all of those scenarios, is that all these parents love their children, want to spend more time with them, but also need to provide for them and also want to live full lives. So how can technology, how can new business models support that want and that need?
And when you're talking to influencers, tastemakers, do you think they're useful to your research because they just have their pulse on cultural trends? Is that why you're tapping into that sort of area for research?
They see a lot of things. They're constantly surrounded by people. They're traveling the world. And so it's just a perspective that's a little bit different than the lay person.
Do you have any trends that you follow in other countries that you think are really interesting and are going to come to the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, one that we kind of invested in was, you know, short form content, right? Which basically originated in Asia, particularly like small bites of reading content, right? So reading like full novels while you're on a bus or train or whatever kind of public transportation. And so we've made some investments kind of in that space. The latest is a company called Lit Video Books, which is essentially taking non-fictional literature and turning them into short form video content. So think of like a Malcolm Gladwell book that you can actually consume in an hour.
Oh, I love that. So staying on content, do you have thoughts on just the implications of streaming and what's going on in the media world right now?
So much, right? It's like my view on it, particularly if we're talking about, you know, streaming video, is that clearly there are more and more platforms coming online, and you kind of have a finite audience number, and that audience has a finite budget. We're not going to be able to have all of these services, right? The content owners are becoming very siloed, putting all their content on their own platform, right? And so at some point, the subscriber base is going to stop growing. So I believe that these streaming platforms, these content companies are going to have to find new monetization strategies. And I think that traditional like advertising, commercials, don't work on paid platforms. So I think there are going to be some creative ways to have advertising show up in what feels like an organic way, right? And that's what led to, you know, our investment in Riff, which is basically doing post-production, three-dimensional, context-relevant product placement, initially just in on streaming platforms, but now also, you know, tapping into the creator economy. So doing it for like TikTok videos.
Interesting. So there's going to be more advertising innovation.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not even advertising. Maybe that's the wrong word. It's ways of for brands to interact.
Advertising doesn't have to be a dirty word. so we could call it advertising. It's basically there are going to be new ways for brands to integrate in the things that we're participating in.
Well, that's a good way of saying it without saying advertising. And let's unpack a little bit more in terms of what you're helping companies do and how you're working with your portfolio.
Yeah, so there are three things that we typically do to add value to our portfolio companies. One, you know, tapping back into that vast and diverse network that we've built across media, entertainment, sports, Fortune 500, the major advertising, global advertising agencies, we're able to, and we have relationships at the, you know, the highest levels within these companies. And what we're able to do is, you know, where it makes sense, introduce those companies to our portfolio companies so that they can start to partner together. And, you know, we've seen this play out in, you know, in great ways. You know, the company RIP that I mentioned, product placement company, we made an introduction to WPP, which is, you know, kind of the global advertising leader. And they have an exclusive partnership in place right now.
What does that exclusive relationship look like? I don't interact that much with the advertising agencies.
So WPP has relationships with a lot of brands, right? Mm. And they also have relationships with a lot of content platforms. So think television stations, for instance, right? And so the partnership is basically to bring, have RIF sit between those two sets of customers. So WPP is out doing the selling and RIF is a technology solution that's making what they're selling possible. Hmm. It's just a matter of having that, the right contact for the right company and right opportunity. And so the skill set here is really, one, it's relationship building, because you have to have the relationships in place and nurture them and all that. But the other is being able to determine, you know, what makes for a good introduction. Is there going to be a value exchange on both sides of that introduction? That's actually a skill, right? And we all come from services backgrounds that required us to build that muscle.
Is there any insight you can share on that beyond just only making the introductions when you really see the value on both sides? Are there different things you've learned along the way?
Listening and, you know, staying connected and making sure that you truly understand, you know, your partner's businesses and their priorities. Particularly with large companies, those priorities can shift very quickly, right? So part of the skill is like keeping your finger on the pulse, right? Staying in touch.
That's a good skill. I'm still working on it, Marlon. Okay. Okay, but I was listening enough to know that was thing one, you know, having that network and opening that network was the first thing you said you do for your portfolio companies. So I interrupted.
Oh, okay. Thing two is operations, right? So just we've all come from services organizations, but we've also operated and we've started things. It's one thing to give advice to a portfolio CEO when you've never done it, you've never sat in the seat, you never felt the level of anxiety and pressure. That's the second. And then the third is storytelling, right? You know, we believe like deeply that the way that you tell your story at the onset has outsized impact on, you know, how large your company ultimately gets. You've got to be able to tell your story in a way that people understand it. They get it. It's dead simple. I get the value proposition, right? I know who we're targeting and why we're targeting them.
What do you see as like common mistakes, if you can, around storytelling?
Too complex, focusing too much on the technology, right? I've seen great technology companies just like struggle to tell the world, you know, why their technology matters, right? Like the ordinary person does not care, you know, that you have widget X, Y, and Z, right? They just care that widget X, Y, and Z have come together to create this thing that's going to help them solve this problem.
Are there any ways that have been particularly effective for you guys in helping some of these companies tell their story better?
Yeah, we usually do an onboarding meeting with our portfolio companies once the investment is done. And, you know, it could be 1 hour, it could be like three or a full day meeting. And we get in the room or a virtual room and we really drive towards who are you targeting and what value are you trying to bring to them? And then just trying to figure out ways to simplify that messaging and then put it out there. And we also, you know, do things like, well, what are the right channels for you to get your message out there, right? What is the best approach for this particular company, its target demographic or audience, and the messaging?
So I'm going to move off of onboarding. I mean, maybe you did onboarding for Pipe. I'm just going to move on to Pipe for a second because holy crap, Marlon, I believe you invested in a 13 million seed round and they just raised that valuation over 2 billion, like a year later, less than a year later.
Yeah, we invested and I was fortunate to lead that one for us, but we invested in September of 2019.
Well done. I'm jealous.
Thanks. Fingers crossed it holds. I think it will. And, you know, it's a nice outcome for everyone involved.
Was there anything interesting, like when they were raising their seed, did some people not get it? Was it, you know, hard to get into?
I think it was hard to get into for a lot of folks. I think the value proposition was pretty clear. We were lucky because we had invested in Skirt, which was Harry and Josh's first company that, you know, was ultimately acquired by Fair. And so as they were exiting Fair and they, you know, stumbled upon this problem of, you know, dilution and raising either equity or debt. And I think we were probably the first meeting that they took for this. And it was also a very easy decision for David Sachs, who actually wrote the initial term sheet. We participated in that round, but he wrote the term sheet after sitting in the meeting with them for maybe 15 minutes. So it was that kind of a clear value proposition.
So David Sachs sat in a room with them for 15 minutes. And I think I did kind of hear this. And they walked out with a term sheet before the end of the meeting or something.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Oh, if only it were always so easy. So here's, I'm going to change topics off of Mac a little bit because you've had the opportunity to be at a few different funds. And I'm curious, maybe give us the basics of cross culture, but also when you were going from cross culture to Mac, what were things where you said, you know, I definitely want to replicate this, or, you know, I have the opportunity to do something slightly differently.
Yeah. So I had the privilege to learn the business of venture at Intel Capital. Mm. That was a 5-year stint. Became a Kauffman Fellow during that time and continued to learn from some incredible people. And I left Intel because I wanted to create a vehicle that would allow me to invest in the founders that really resonated with me. We really just wanted to test this cultural investing thesis, not necessarily a strategic mandate of a big corporation. And so that's kind of how, you know, cross culture was born. But, you know, coming out of the investment period, it was the conversation between Troy and I was, well, what's next, right? You know, for him, it was like, okay, do you really want to be a full-time general partner in a venture firm that would take you away from, you know, your passion, which is music? Or do you want to do your music thing and continue to angel invest? And, you know, that answer was clearly he wanted to do the latter, right? So for me then, it was, well, okay, well, how do we continue? And that meant to grow the team, essentially, right? Now we've got 3 full-time partners and 1 part-time general partner, right, in Charles. Only other thing that's changed is the check size, right? And in cross culture, we didn't really have ownership targets, right? We're a fairly small fund. So you just, whatever check you were able to write, you wrote that with conviction and tried to be helpful. Right. Well, now, you know, we write $1.5 to $2 million checks in these seed stage companies, oftentimes leading the rounds. Right.
Maybe it's a little wonky stuff, but do you have thoughts on the operational aspect of getting your ownership in your first check, continuing to follow on invest?
Yeah. So we like to lead the deal, and it that fits with the way that we're seeing the world. Right. We are in the business of identifying opportunities before the rest of the world understands that there's an opportunity there. So we'll lead, and then we aim for about 10% ownership after our initial investment. And you know, if a company is going to be an amazing company, you want to hold on to as much of that for as long as possible, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of working backwards in your background, and I want to talk a little bit about Intel. But before I leave cross culture, I have to ask the same question. What is Troy Carter like? Is he also glass half full?
Troy's an amazing human and one of my best friends. One of his favorite sayings is take big swings, right? And so if you're not half glass, half full, I don't know if you're taking big swings, right? When I left Intel, it was a moment for me where I was like, okay, it's time to bet on yourself, and you're gonna play to win, and you're gonna go try to play in the big game, right? I think I came into our partnership with that mindset, but it was like, you know, it was underscored if it were, right? And you know, if I continue to do this, and you know, this is what success might look like.
Right? Like you went from Intel Capital to all of a sudden your partners with Troy Carter.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that was kind of a serendipitous thing, actually. I didn't go into this thinking that, oh, I needed to partner with Troy. One of the first investors that I talked to about Cross Culture said, oh, you should meet Troy. I think he'd love what you're doing. And literally our first conversation was around him being an investor in the fund, which turned into, why don't we build this thing together? I didn't even know who he was when they told me, you know, you should go meet this guy. Yes, it's funny how these things happen.
Yeah. And you built a diversity focused fund, as I understand it, at Intel?
We did. So I helped Lisa architect it, sell it to the company and launch it, and then started investing out of it. It was a $125 million fund focused on women, Black, Latinx, Native American, like startups.
And what do you think people in our industry broadly should be doing differently or just doing to help around these initiatives?
Around the diversity initiative?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our societal initiatives.
Yeah. Just be good humans is the short answer, right? Like do things in an equitable manner.
Marlon, I think when I asked you this before, you said, be less racist.
Yeah, basically.
Right? I mean, are there particular areas where you think people still are falling short?
I mean, it's hard to boil it down to one or two particular areas. I think you just got to start looking at people, as opposed to, you know, when a Black founder walks into your door, oh, that's a Black founder. I mean, when a white founder walks into your door, I don't think you're saying, oh, that's a white founder, right? You're looking at their credentials, you're looking at the opportunity, and you're making a decision, you know, based on their skill set, their professional experience, their lived experience, et cetera. Hmm.
And what about you and your journey? What was high school for you?
I went to an all-boys Catholic high school in the Bronx called Mount St. Michael.
How was it? What was your, you know, what was the day-to-day for you?
As a two-sport athlete, I played basketball, I ran track. I was a good student because my parents would have it no other way. I have Jamaican parents. I was born in Jamaica. So you either, you know, do well in school or you got consequences.
And they had both immigrated then? They had both grown up in Jamaica?
Yeah, I was born there. And so, you know, that story is we moved over. My dad used to work on trains, and then he became a bus mechanic in the U.S. My mom was a cosmetologist. Initially, she became a nanny and housekeeper while she got her license in the U.S. And then she ultimately opened her own salon and still running that salon today. So that was kind of like my first, I guess, view or access exposure to entrepreneurship and how hard it is, how rewarding it can be, fulfilling it can be, how hard it is.
That's a great story. One more question for you. I know you're a serious basketball player. What, when you're getting really competitive, what goes on in your brain? What do you tell yourself?
Just that, you know, we got to win and nobody's better than, you know, the other team is not better than us. We're better. No matter what, and we got to win.
So, wow. You tell yourself we're better. Like what? That's good. That's good.
Yeah. I tell myself that in, you know, in our current business too. It's like, I don't care who's on the other side of the table. Like we're better. Mm.
I think a lot of what you tell yourself in sports carries over to the way you approach life. So I appreciate that advice and that perspective. Well, Marlon, thank you so much for coming on the show. And congratulations on Fund One and also that amazing pipe investment.
Well, thank you for that. We're just taking a blue collar mentality to this and, you know, building brick by brick. And hopefully at the end of the day, you would have created something phenomenal and, you know, helped entrepreneurs bring their vision to the world.
I love it. Thanks, Marlon. That's a great note to end on.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Real quick, it would be great if you could spare a moment to give the podcast 5 stars or share with a friend. Or I love getting emails. Send me a note, mini@10110.net. Thanks.